Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Gray Malkin Lane Patreon channel. I am so excited to be recording an episode that I have been anticipating for a while. That of the character Zeitgeist with my respected friend and colleague, Michael Elliott. Before I even introduce Michael, there have been some key moments on this show where, I've introduced myself to someone who does something so odd or revolutionary or surprising that it causes me to kind of look at things a little bit different afterward. And my first time at FlameCon, I was walking around and enthusiastically introducing myself to people, saying, "Hey, I have a podcast and I want to talk to you." I had the incredible honor of meeting Mr. Michael Elliott. Michael came on with Justin Hall, who was another just paradigm shifting individual. And we got to talk a lot about the sociology of comic book nerds. I've had Michael on once more, but often when I'm entering a new era or researching a new topic on my show, Michael and his work will often cross my mind. So I'm really excited to get to hang out with Michael one-on-one today, and we're talking about a character that could not be more appropriate given what Michael does, which is a character by the name of Zeitgeist, who we will be getting into in a few minutes. First, let me extend a very warm welcome to the incredible Michael Elliott. Michael, how are you? It's great to see you this morning.
I'm very well, Chad. It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
We are recording this early in the new year on 2024. We'll be putting this out at the end of January on the Patreon channel. I would love for you, for our listeners who may be less familiar, to tell them a little bit about yourself and the work that you do.
Happy to do it. So my name is Michael Elliott. I'm a professor of sociology at Towson University, which is just outside Baltimore in Maryland. I got my degree, my PhD in sociology from Emory University in 2008. Currently, one of my major projects is exploring the sacred dimensions of Comic-Con fan communities, which I've talked about with Chad a couple of times. And this is a sort of my contribution, a social scientific contribution to the fandom as religion approach. And one thing that I'm trying to add to this literature is some systematic data. So the reason I met Chad a couple years ago at FlameCon was because I was distributing my survey and recruiting interviewees. And I've been doing this for a couple years, going to Comic-Cons. I have a survey that I distribute. I recruit interviewees, and I've been collecting data for several years now, trying to operationalize and test and see the variations and how different fan communities, different fans experience their fandom.
It's a fascinating thing. I haven't spoken to you in several months. I would love to hear an update on how your research is going. And I would love for you to answer for our listeners, what is your intent with this research?
Oh, very good. I've been preparing a new manuscript to send for publication. You can stay updated on those publications via my personal website. Maybe we can give a shout out to that at the end of the podcast, which Absolutely. We often do. I have a lot of data. So, you know, I have over 500 survey respondents and about 40 in-depth interviews, working largely on my own. So it takes some time to get through these, a lot of open-ended questions to go through and code. So that's where I'm at, is systematically analyzing these and writing them up and presenting them to sort of the fan studies community right now. And that's the next manuscript that I'll be submitting. But I'm also a sociologist, and so I'll also be doing some more sophisticated things with the data, submitting them to sociology journals as well. So that's where I stand with that project. And
I am fascinated by your brain and by this research itself. But keep going. I'm really enthusiastic about this.
Yeah. So the ultimate goal is to publish a book. That is the end goal. I'm hoping to get there soon. I'd like to get to about 1,000 survey respondents. So for all you statisticians out there, it's a good number to have statistically to make sure you have good reliability in the data and the answers. So I'm getting close. I applied for another grant that might get me to New York Comic Con, which would probably get me enough respondents to get close to that 1,000 number. And then I can start to look for book contracts if I can get them. I need to go through the interviews, which is a very painstaking process because those are long. They're pages and pages long, anywhere from about 25 minutes to an hour and 15 minutes, these interviews that I have with different fans. So I'll be going through those as well, but that's the ultimate goal.
We are not going to spend a lot of time talking about reliability and validity and statistics and all the things
that
requires
I'm so pumped about that.
To put together this type of research. But I've had the pleasure more recently to get to know Andrew DeMann, who runs the Claremont Run and has recently published a book about the Claremont Run. And it's all data sets. Who speaks most often in the comics? Which women make which decisions during which eras? Who has the most revenge plots? And he shows all of his data charts. And I'm like, oh, yes, I love there's a piece of me, the sociologist piece of me, that just really fires up when I look at this type of data. Doing this show has been a fascinating thing. It started out with just kind of, hey, let's have some friends and some comics. But right from the beginning, I was using a lot of this research stuff. If you go back and listen to my initial intro episode, I'm like, here's what the world was like in 1963. And here's how the X-Men compare to other heroes. We're in a new era on my show as the new year begins, jumping into the early 70s. And we're going to talk about this term zeitgeist in just a minute. But we can, from a cultural perspective, at different times and different places, look at trends and the way that they influence storytelling. If you go back and listen to the first episode I put out this year about Amazing Adventures 11, I take time to set up what was happening in the country, the feminism movements and Watergate and Stonewall and civil rights and Vietnam and hippies and protesting. And it totally influences the types of media we were consuming at the time. But at the same time, I also put out there what was happening in animation, what is happening for different trends in the media. I think a lot of modern X-Men readers started with kind of the early 90s relaunch of the books and then into the cartoons and then into the films. And we kind of start that with like the MTV generation, which then becomes the Y2K generation. You know, coming out of the war on Iraq and before the internet was even kind of really trending, which didn't start until the new year. This character Zeitgeist that we're going to be talking about is a mutant character who's created during a particular time. And the way he's portrayed across different times changes because that's kind of the meaning of his name. Before we get into it very quickly, I'll just mention this once. There are other characters out there named Zeitgeist. The one that's most prominent at Marvel was a character that's created in the early 1980s. It's a character named Larry Eckler, who is part of a group called Schutzheilergruppe. It's a Mark Grenwald kind of thing. He uses it once in a while. He appears in like Alpha Flight and Marvel Team Up. And this character, Zeitgeist, Axel Clooney, who we'll be talking about today, is a much more prominent and well-developed character, and one of those rare characters that's basically only used in the hands of his creators. He doesn't really have much besides Peter Milligan and Mike Allred, who we'll be talking a lot about today, with this kind of very unique corner of the X-Men world. So before we get lost there, talk to me about the term Zeitgeist and what it was that caused you to choose this character for us to review.
I wanted to approach an episode exactly the way that you just described it, Chad, and the way you've approached the show. One of the things that fascinates me about comics, I mean, I love comics as a reader and as a medium, but I love how they often reflect the life and times in which they were written. So you can look at the themes, and they're often written as metaphors, as analogies to contemporary times. And so in thinking about what we could do on this show, I wanted to pick something like that, a character that was really symbolic, that was metaphorical, and that had something to say rather prominently about the life and times in which that character was written.
The term Zeitgeist, I think the direct translation is spirit of the times, We can look in the, and again, this is going to be a very American conversation. I recognize that zeitgeist changes by culture and by what's happening, and the Western trends kind of bleed over into other places, etc. But the if we go to 2001, when this character was created, the zeitgeist of the times is really interesting. I was, from the years 1997 to 1999, I was a Mormon missionary knocking on doors and pretending that that would make me straight, because that's what they told me. Messed up, right? But also, I grew up in some pretty small towns. Even then, though, I look back at this era, at how news stories about the war on Iraq and the invasion of Kuwait, how Rodney King and Matthew Shepard and the AIDS crisis were kind of forming. Then we get into the later 90s, where we've got stuff like Columbine. 2001, of course, is the era of the Twin Towers and our conversation about terrorism changing. The show 24 is launching. Reality TV is really starting to kick in. Where were you in 2001, Michael?
Oh, that's a great question. I was in graduate school in Atlanta at Emory University.
At all of the universities.
Yeah, that's where I was in 2001. And one of the things I remember, because I was a little bit older than my colleagues when I started graduate school, I went off and worked for a little while before I went back and got my PhD. They were younger. So they were fresh out of college. They were 22, 23. And I remember the birth of some of these very early social media sites, which is what I remember from that time period. You rattled off a whole bunch of really interesting stuff in terms of 2001. I remember, you know, the internet, email, instant messaging, but also that the cusp of social media platforms. Friendster was huge. MySpace was huge.
Gay.com for the queer listeners.
There you go. Just getting off the ground. And my younger colleagues were all over it.
Netflix was a up and coming business where you had to get, you know, things in the mail. Do you remember like Redbox? Like you'd go down to the place and like get the DVD. This was an interesting time. It is not that long ago. I'm only 45. And late 90s, getting the internet, which took over your phone line and had those annoying dial-up sounds and AOL era. By the way, whenever I am interviewing or reaching out to creators on the show, anyone over 70 often still has their like AOL address, which cracks me up. They're the ones that are still on Facebook. You can almost find people based on the generation they come from. But the zeitgeist of the times is an interesting thing because we are born during different eras. We come from parents who have cultural values related to the eras they grew up in, which then influence us. But then we're changing over time as well. I think I've shared this on my show before, but my grandparents, as an example, grew up in the Great Depression, which was like the scarcity model, and you use everything always. And then my mom and dad were born in the baby boomer generation, which is a very different set of values. We're watching these times change, and a lot of these books, the X-Men just hit their 60th anniversary, so there's a lot of zeitgeist mixed into all of that.
I remember you mentioned 9/11. I remember being in the classroom, and this was the first class I taught as a graduate student. And ironically enough, it was a globalization class, which is one of the areas that I took my comprehensive exams in. And so here was an example of this massive global event. And it's one of those things I'll never forget. And universities, they kind of shut down for a day or two. There was this collective panic that permeated the United States, I remember. And everyone took a little break for a couple of days. But I remember coming back and talking about it as something very global, because it wasn't just an attack on the United States. It was something that everybody felt. And so embassies all around the world were commenting on it. And that's one of the things I remember vividly, was seeing the different ways that this event that happened in Manhattan was truly global.
It really changed everything. I think even for Americans, it changed their sense of security, which frankly, we kind of deserve, because Americans had been bombing these other countries for a long time while telling us it was in the name of patriotism. You know, like we're changing our conversation even now in the current zeitgeist of the era. Now, Marvel as a company in 2001 is another fascinating thing. They weren't doing great financially. Image Comics had just launched. Creators were really fighting hard for rights. They were doing a bunch of experimental stuff in this era. This is kind of right after Age of Apocalypse and the Ultimate Universe and Onslaught. But they were also doing some really big shakeups in the current books. This is the era when Grant Morrison transformed the X-Men from one thing into another. There's a lot of pinup Cheesecake girls on covers. This is the Weapon X era. Everybody's sexy and busty and like standing in stances in a different way than during the Liefeld era. But again, this is the era of reality TV, which we cannot underestimate the impact of reality TV on this particular book and this particular character. So X-Force has been running for a long time. It's a fan favorite book. It's one of my all-time favorite books. And just like they did with Morrison's X-Men, they completely swap out the creative team. They give us a completely different version of everything. And this is an era for mutants when mutants were everywhere. Mutants at this time, this is right around Genosha as well, but there are millions of mutants existing in the culture around the world. We get hints of them when we see characters like Jumbo Carnation, or District X was a book during this era, which is a whole town full of mutants and their problems. X-Force is about like the celebrity, rich and famous, pretty mutants who are good for a buck, but there is an era or an aura of like body horror to this book as well. High body count. Any character can die at any time, which was a big trend in popular media at the time. And this is Peter Milligan and Mike Allred. Mike Allred has a signature penciling style. It's unlike anyone else. I really love it, actually. It's very wholesome somehow, but it's spliced with like characters getting ripped in half and guts pouring out of people. And there's something kind of magical about his work. I'm also a huge Peter Milligan fan. He's an extremely prolific writer.
I'd love to go back and talk about reality TV a little bit. One of the movies that I remember coming out, which was kind of a meta analysis or commentary on reality TV, was The Truman Show. Came out in 1998. It starred Jim Carrey. And it was, you know, a commentary on sort of the ethics and morality of reality TV. And Jim Carrey's character was born and raised in a reality TV environment. He didn't know it, but the whole world was watching him grow up and be raised in this reality environment. You know, I'm trying to think of some of the different reality TV shows that were well established. There was MTV, of course.
I mean, we had stuff that had been around a little bit once in a while. I mean, game shows are a form of reality TV, but there's all these kind of old shows like Candid Camera and Bloopers and different things. I mean, Cops was in the late 80s, which is a huge one. The Real World in the early 90s, yes. And kind of using edgier youth voices and all of that. Do you remember Road Rules?
I remember the title. Refresh my memory.
I'm dating myself. But across the way, we started getting the idea of putting a whole bunch of people together. You start with a cast of 16 or 20. You put premises and rules around it, and you start voting someone out every episode until you're down to the last. So there's a through line that goes all the way through it. It's always a tryout. And this model has been used over and over, from Big Brother to Survivor, which is one of my all-time favorites, to The Amazing Race, to The Biggest Loser, to RuPaul's Drag Race, which is America's Next Top Model, even MasterChef, right? Like, there's entire franchises built on this same formula with slightly different tweaks to what it looks like. The early X-Force book we're going to be talking about has very much that energy in a way, but it's also just the worst part of celebrities, because we hold celebrities to extremely high esteem, we give them a lot of money, and then we make every excuse possible for whatever bad behavior. This is the era of Britney Spears shaving her head and Lindsay Lohan, opening her legs and having that unfortunate photo taken as she gets out of the car. And there's drug rehab and everybody's talking about all the excuses we make all the time. So this is that era. And celebrity mixing with reality TV.
Talk a little bit more about the model of reality TV shows. I mean, is it fair to say that some of the allure of those shows is its trashiness?
Absolutely.
Right? And people talk about their favorite reality show as being, sort of their escape.
I mean, trash reality TV, I didn't even talk about that. It doesn't occur to me as much because I hate it. But the Kardashians and the Real Housewives.
Yeah. We talk about reality TV actually in Sociology 101. Because one of the concepts that we explore is the concept of a role, and how a lot of action in our own daily lives is structured by our roles as students, as professors, as parents. And those roles have certain expectations that go along with them. You learn them as you grow up. It's part of our socialization in society, is how you play those roles. And I think one of the allures of reality TV is that, you know, these roles are fabricated. They're scripted. I think I've read that the Jersey Shore people aren't even Italian, but it doesn't matter, because the important thing.
God, I forgot about Jersey Shore too. Situation and Snooki were fucking everywhere.
Yes. The point is that you create a sensational role And you need to perform or act out the role in an entertaining way. It doesn't matter if they're actually Italian Americans or not. It's entertainment.
I'm remembering Glee starting and how much I loved Glee. But then there was also a reality show where people would be in a competition and the winner got to join the cast of Glee afterward. Like everything was capitalized. I got everything. And it's in every genre. And we just obsess over it. It's intense. 2001, when we jump to the inception of this new era of X-Force. This is an era that a lot of comic fans or a lot of X-Men fans are fond of, but it's never been something that has really connected with the X-Men proper world, which is crazy because there's a lot of characters, there's a lot of body count, but they kind of have their own set of villains, their own set of characters, and it's just been a thing that's been entirely separate, almost in a way that like the Avengers and the Fantastic Four crossover with the X-Men more than these guys. When the Sentinels attack mutants, they don't come after this cast of characters, right? They have their entirely separate thing going. The only character that has really made that jump from one to the other is Duke, who is a little green, lumpy guy. This is the Ren and Stimpy era. We create this nonsensical character who's like a sex symbol cameraman, but also just the weird guy that nobody can understand. He's Slimer from the Ghostbusters. Like, this is not a Dupe episode, but Dupe's kind of the most popular character out of all of these comics. Do you have any Dupe thoughts?
What struck me is that references in the books as him being a sex symbol. And it just made me laugh out loud because I'm like, of course. In this era, taken to the extreme, the floating Martian with the camera would be a sex symbol somehow.
He's like a potato with arms, but green. Fascinating. I Boop is his own kind of zeitgeist, if you will. Now, before we had decided to do this, had you read these comics before, or was this entirely new material for you?
This was entirely new material for me.
Fascinating. And to read these comics from a 2023 perspective, I had not read them in many years. I'm fond of them, mostly because I love the art. I also really enjoy the high action pace. We're not going to spend a ton of time about the book itself, simply because we're going to be talking about Zeitgeist, but this book was very controversial. It hit major news a lot of the times. There are stories about an immigrant child, which is a clear parody of Elian Gonzalez. There's a story about a princess who dies tragically, which is a clear reference to Princess Diana. It's really pushing the limit. It's irreverent. Again, there's a high body count. It's making fun of culture. It's making fun of race. It's making fun of homosexuality. It's making fun of celebrity. It's making fun of addiction and mental illness. It's making fun of sexual assault. And it does it in kind of a way that because everything's on the table, you kind of forget that it's two white guys writing it. And it's a little bit fun, even though it's problematic. It's not problematic in the, like, they were trying to be problematic is kind of what I'm getting at. Rather than ignoring the topics, they were bringing them all to the surface of the table. And everyone is terrible. Every character in this book is terrible.
To the point about the characters all being kind of awful. And all the way through, even through the 2022 run, which we'll talk about, none of them are particularly graceful or moral. So one of my initial reactions was, this is kind of tough to read. It was difficult to latch onto any particular character and say, I'm getting behind this character. They're all nasty. And the other thing that struck me, you know, we've talked a lot about sort of the trashy elements of pop culture, but of course they're countervailing forces. So you mentioned that it was controversial. I have no doubt. I was trying to remember when Tipper Gore was doing her thing, pushing
back. Oh, God, Tipper Gore.
on music and trying to put labels on them for explicit content. I mean, that goes back to earlier decades as well, but no doubt there's pushback against this kind of thing too. And comics have, you know, in earlier decades been flashpoints for that, have they not?
The particular story that stands out, and this is worthy of a longer conversation, but when they were doing the Princess Diana episode, I was reading comics at the time, and there was this hit like national news, and like the British royal family was upset. They felt like it was disrespectful. They wanted to ban the book. So they had to change the character's name, but it was still pretty controversial. There was a lot of crazy stuff happening in the books at the time too. There was a prequel series about like Aunt May and like Uncle Ben from Spider-Man, but they were like sexy on the beach in bikinis. Like there's a bunch of weird stuff that was like really controversial. And then that was kind of how you were selling books at the time, is by making them controversial, by pushing that limit, but you couldn't push it too far. I do enjoy the ingenuity of these characters. We so often see the strong guy and the energy guy and the claw guy, right? But all of these characters have powers that are, I don't know that I would want any of their powers. They're all a little bit disgusting. They're all very self-absorbed. They're all very naive to the ways of the world and only wanting to cash in on whatever it is. And Zeitgeist is the worst of them, but they're all terrible. From The Orphan to Tyke Alucard to You Go Girl, you know, they all have their own struggles and addictions and problems, but they're all awful characters in their own way, which kind of makes it great, because if everybody's terrible, then no one's the hero, right? Before we jump to Zeitgeist specifically, what were some of your standout characters from this era?
Oh gosh, they made me laugh. So, you know, and that's part of the trashiness that they reflect was kind of the ridiculous powers they have and the ridiculous names that they have. I mean, You Go Girl, that the name itself just makes me laugh out loud. Yeah, a character at the beginning of this initial run who only lasted a couple pages. His name was Slook, and his power was he had a really creepy face and he would just get in people's faces and wave his tentacles. We have a couple characters that are blobs and their names were Fat and Fatty, but not spelled F-A-T, but P-H-A-T. Going back to the lingo of the times, that's so fat.
Fat is, and this is again, another conversation for another time. Fat is a character who's initially kind of a farm boy who's homophobic, but he realizes he's gay by hanging out with Vivisector. And then they end up becoming this like long-term couple, which is a weird way to do a gay love story, but it's very interesting. And then his daughter Fatty, Phatty, who is problematic in all the ways Big Bertha is problematic. She's a shifting mass of, she's blob, but it's uncomfortable to see a character named Fatty who's just running around on the page and comes across as slightly mentally ill. If I'm honest, it's an uncomfortable character for me. But keep going. I'm sorry.
No, absolutely. And they're so insecure. You know, you're right. They're just looking for ways to, you know, cash in on fame, be more popular, have more followers. They're just so shallow.
I did not draw the parallel till this moment, but this book is a contemporary in ways of the book that becomes the series, The Boys, which is all about this as well. The Seven and their claim to fame and like the company that's managing them and all the horrible things they're doing. This is kind of Marvel's version of that in some way, which is a thought that hadn't occurred to me until now. I don't know if you've seen The Boys. It's
Oh, absolutely. So yeah. that struck me as a parallel as well. I can't remember when those books started, but it definitely reminds me of sort of the way we're deconstructing superheroes now is how would a superhero really act in real life? Well, some of them would be really nasty. They would try to take over the world. They would just try to be popular and cash in on their fame. This one was doing it back in 2001. So perhaps prescient in that sense.
The Garth Ennis book, The Boys, started in 2006. So relatively contemporary. But yeah, it's an interesting thing. So we're going to focus on Zeitgeist specifically. There's a lot of stories in this. We're not going to be comprehensive, and we're not talking about the other characters. We're kind of just focusing in the way that we have been so far on a particular character who represents this in a particular way. Zeitgeist's real name is Axel Clooney, which is clearly, I don't know, it comes across as Axel Rose and George Clooney to me. These are names that are, I mean, Clooney is a strong choice for 2001.
Oh my gosh, I hadn't thought about it. But Clooney was famous, I should say, infamous, probably around this time for his work on the Batman movies, the Joel Schumacher ones, which were kind of a disaster. So this was probably not the high point of George Clooney's career.
Axel Clooney and all the characters have gross powers in a lot of ways. They end up like schlopped apart. They have weird face tentacles. They have like sweat that explodes things. Like all of the powers are very like undesirable. Axel is a relatively attractive looking character. He's a blonde, fit man who has the power to spew acidic vomit. And there are a bajillion scenes of him vomiting on someone and having their flesh or skin just being eaten away on their like face or hands, and they end up permanently burned or scarred. And he's obsessed with control. He wears a form-fitting kind of black and gold costume with an X on it, and he has to wear this like face mask all the time, presumably because if the vomit gets out on its own, that's a problem, so you gotta drop the mask. Sort of like Cyclops with his optic blast, but just much, much grosser power.
I actually like the choice of the face mask from an artistic standpoint, because it's a constant reminder of his power. and how dangerous it is. And so when you look at the mask, you're always reminded, oh, that's right. He could spew vomit on you at any minute. And it's gross.
But there's something disconcerting about the visual of this character. It's just dawning on me now. I think there's like a urine yellow color to his powers. His eyes go yellow. His mask is yellow. The vomit is this yucky kind of woof color. You know, the Ninja Turtles, the sludge is bright green, but this is this like off-putting kind of puce color. I don't know. It's unpleasant. In the beginning, we get his origin. There's a flashback to him kissing a girl. Think back to Rogue kissing Cody Robbins when her powers kicked in, right? He's kissing a girl, and in his own narration, he says, "This is my dream. Only it's not just a dream. It really happened. It's the day that everything changed. That's me 13 years ago. I'm 14. She's 13. We're in love and about to prove it. Basically, we're going to break the law." Which is an even bigger aphrodisiac than the bottle of warm wine that we shared at the party. I can't breathe. My stomach is a furnace. Something is cooking in there. I can't remember her name. We'd only met that evening. All I remember is her face. I sure hope the doctors managed to give her back her pretty face. Maybe if I could remember her name, I'd stop dreaming about her. What happens in this flashback? Do you want to talk to us? First of all, this narration tells us a lot about this guy.
Oh my gosh.
We were in love and about to prove it. What?
What a moment to have your powers manifest, right? I mean, usually it's some kind of stress or strain, but here it was sexual arousement. Poor Axel. I mean, I certainly did feel for him in this moment. Instead of kissing, he spewed his toxic vomit all over this young woman.
Which it is not directly stated, and I'm going to make it sexual, but this is kind of like he prematurely ejaculated and this girl got burned to a crisp as a result. It's very uncomfortable when you look at it in that light, right?
Oh my gosh. It is. Absolutely. And it follows them all through his life. So even in the 2022 run, they're still referencing it. So one of the things I think we should talk about in terms of psychology is his self-loathing.
The mutant who hates himself, who has murdered people with his powers, who is now exhibiting himself as a celebrity with a sense of entitlement and leadership. And here's what the world owes me. The perspective he has is constantly that. And then he goes insane toward the end, which we'll talk about. And that insanity kind of matches the modern zeitgeist, which we'll get to in a few minutes, because this character isn't around for long at the beginning. Do you remember Lost? Lost was one of my favorites in this era. Major characters dying off all the time. And the character Jack, the lead, I can't remember who played him, Matthew Fox or somebody. They were going to kill him off in the first episode. And they're like, oh no, maybe we should, you know, turn it around. Then you got Game of Thrones where like Sean Bean's character's killed at the end of the first season by beheading. And like these major characters dying that are headliners. This is what they do in Scream over and over too, right? So this is that thing. Everybody's dying all the time in this book. And it happens to Zeitgeist pretty quickly. I'll tell the story, but share me your thoughts here.
That was shocking. I mean, that he died that quick and that the team almost was completely obliterated in this glory mission that they were supposedly going on, that was supposed to, you know, boost their popularity and be this big triumph for the team. They were massacred, including Axel.
The original team is Lanute, Battering Ram, Plasm, Yugo Girl, Dupe, Gingini, and Sluck. And I'm not going to talk a lot about them, but they've been sent to North Africa to fight, quote, a nasty little coup by fanatical tribesmen, most of them out of their minds on cat. QAT, it's a drug. We're not going to talk about it. Zeitgeist is vomiting acid on soldiers who are burning away. After the mission, we see him in his briefs in a chair with a threesome, like after a threesome with some girls. He likes watching his battles, like his own footage after he has sex, he notes. He's making notes about how effective his team is at brutally slaying African people from another country. It's very uncomfortable. Anyway, and he also makes a comment on how he prefers human-looking mutants. So this guy is not good, and they are not making any aspersions that this is a your normal X-Men book. This is a team of bad guys. Sex, watching himself in combat, killing people of color horribly, obsessed with himself, and also, I like normal-looking mutants myself. So different era of sensitivity, everyone.
He's despicable, isn't he?
He's really awful. He's like extremely reprehensible, which is the thing you have to like most about him, because he's awful. Sluck dies. We meet the team manager, Coach. Do you want to talk to us about Coach and his role in this book?
Well, that was interesting. It reminded me of sort of like a public relations firm that, you know, constructs boy bands, that constructs these reality TV shows, which we, if we suspend our disbelief, we believe these people are real in these scenarios, in these bands. trends, but they're not. They've been put together. They've been researched. You've had focus groups on them. So the coach was that kind of character to me, but he's also a mutant. Is that right? His eyes are red and the references to it.
Coach does have red eyes. He has a previous superhero name as the Arm. He's superhuman. He is strong. He is mutant. He doesn't last too long, but you kind of get the idea that he is trying to relive his lost youth through these characters that he's trying to make famous. He doesn't play a huge role in the series. In fact, he dies kind of horribly himself, just like everyone does. And then we meet Tyke Alucard, who is the anarchist, who is another very unlikable character with an off-putting power. But in a lot of ways, well, between he and Mr. Sensitive and later, I guess, Venus de Milo a little bit, they're kind of the voices of reason in the team, but they're all awful. Do you want to talk to us about the anarchist at all?
They are awful, but you're right. They are more self-aware, and they sort of cut through the crap a little bit, if you will, to sort of remind us how despicable this whole project is, the X-Force. Sometimes I'm wondering about how the whole anatomy of some of these powers work. So the anarchist has toxic sweat, but he's got the spandex uniform on. And I'm thinking to myself, how does this work anatomically?
You know, Mr. Fantastic created those unstable molecules. So like Johnny Storm's clothes don't start on fire. maybe they got a deal here. The early inception, and again, we're not going to cover a lot of the X-Force run, but what ends up happening is Tyke joins the team. He's the new black guy questioning the white guy in power. Like, is your leadership effective? But Axel doesn't get really upset until Yugo Girl starts challenging him as well. Like, she's struggling with addiction and has her own kind of issues. But she basically says, you know, be a better leader or step down. Coach sends X-Force to rescue some hostages. There's a band named Boys R Us, which is a clear reference of Boys to Men and Toys R Us in a weird way, from some gunmen who have open fire. X-Force attacks. The fight goes on. And here's Zeitgeist's thoughts in this initial fight. He goes, money, fame, sex, cars, houses, champagne, talk shows, cafes, limousines, immortality, luck, just the peanuts they throw at us. They'd hate us if we couldn't do this. They'd fear us. They adore us now. They know we're here. What the point of us is? But I'm still a mutant, you idiots. I'm still 14 years old. I burnt that girl's face off. I'm a freak, and I hate you all. But then they get pretty violently slaughtered, and Zeitgeist's leg gets blown off, and his guts are falling out, and then he's dead. Goodbye. And the orphan's the new leader. The end. What are your thoughts on the Boys R Us fight? It's a rough beginning, man.
Oh my gosh. It's a little bit of a jaw dropper. But that commentary, that narrative, it just sort of stopped me in my tracks. Yeah, okay, we get it. It's the fame and the money and the limousines. They're all chasing that. But then his tying it into, you know, the dawn of his mutant powers, and his personality is in many ways driven by this self-hatred of himself and recognition as a freak, as if this is the best I can be. This is the best I can be, is this trashy reality, second-rate X-Men character. And to hell with you all.
There's a level of, and I know people like this in my real life, and they have no room in my life, but there's a level of, I am important and you give me everything, but also you never understand me. My life is so much harder than yours. And like, there's clearly some extreme narcissism with this man. Very uncomfortable. It turns out he's not dead. He's kind of a background looming memory in the rest, well, in key moments in the series. He was the initial leader of the team, and now, you know, the new generation of heroes is trying to make the same impact in their reality show that their previous leader, who was awful, was, and, you know, really struggling with the concepts of fame and how to stay on top and how to make themselves popular. There's a lot of really interesting narratives that work in and out of this series with some really uncomfortable stories. For example, we meet a character named Bloke, who is a queer pink rainbow themed like character who was a queer icon in San Francisco as an out gay hero. He quickly gets murdered after joining the team. There's a lot of uncomfortable storylines like that, but again, it's pushing limits in ways that you don't quite expect. Did you read all the way through X-Force, or did you just focus on the Zeitgeist issues?
No, I went all the way through the initial run up until, I think it was issue 120. I wanted to go back a little bit.
Yeah,
because you have more expertise as a counselor and a psychologist. The personality of Axel Clooney, what did you, I mean, you started to touch on it, the narcissism. How do you read his psychology And you know, his the dawning of his powers and who he becomes. How would you psychoanalyze that?
You know, superhero psychology is always a separate thing, and there's whole books about this. But if we're going human psychology, there's a difference between narcissistic behavior, which is I think I'm better than you and entitled to more, and something called narcissistic personality disorder, which is the inherent lifelong belief that I am better and I do deserve more. But it can be accompanied by something called antisocial personality disorder, where a lot of career criminals end up in jail because they see people as less than them, as tools to be used. It's less than sociopathy. It's less than like psychotic sociopathy, right? But there's a level of here's the standard I hold myself to and everyone else is at a lower standard. There's that type of mentality with this guy. Now, who knows how much of this is PTSD related based on his mutants? We don't know a lot about his upbringing, but I think a lot of this exists in Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles, where we have a lot of people pursuing careers based on looks and appearance and connection and what can I get out of this? And this character is like the worst straight character, right? I mean, he's not a Nazi, but he's extraordinarily self-involved. He's glorifying in murder. He sees people as less than him. He's a villain. He's a villain who's leading a quote-unquote hero team, and we've made a celebrity out of him, which I'm not going to name names, but we could think of many modern interpretations of that. People who've literally been accused of murder, but let's put them back on the stand. I mean, O.J. Simpson is a really prime example of this. Like, the celebrity is more important than the act itself.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Mentality. Is there literature about how narcissism is driven by a lack of self-esteem, so that one is constantly trying to boost themselves up because they don't at depth believe that they're worthy?
I think there is a difference, and I'll put my therapist hat on here. There's a difference between using narcissistic traits as a combat for insecurity or trauma. You know, some people, people cope with trauma in different ways. Some people shut down, some people take care of others, some people turn to food, some people become big jerks. But that's more of a psychological condition as opposed to a pervasive personality trait. So I do think there's a difference between a character who may exhibit exhibit narcissism as a defense and other characters. I mean, we love a bully character. We love an asshole. We love Monet St. Croix. We love Emma Frost. We love, you know, North Star. And these are all relatively arrogant characters who borderline on narcissism, but they're heroes. This guy is not a hero. This guy is a murderer who sees people as less than him. He sees people as tools and chips and bargaining pieces. He's the kind of guy that will send you into battle and make you die because you inconvenience him. But then it happens to him and it's, no, it's not fair. This is the worst thing that's ever happened to anyone ever. You know, it's a very different level. Does that answer your question?
It does. I certainly wouldn't want him in my office, in my chair, somebody I had to manage.
But I think we all know a few people like this in our real lives, right? Like we can think of them and they're pretty toxic folks. And so we jump forward ahead a little bit. We're summing up past a lot of stuff where Axel Clooney didn't die and he has a giant reawakening in 2022 when we are putting a lot of effort in the last couple of years in letting classic, that's a harsh word to use, but classic creators retell stories with characters that they love or worked on. So Milligan and Allred have had the opportunity to revisit these concepts in the modern era. How has the zeitgeist of the times changed from 2001 to 2022, Michael Elliott?
Oh, this is fascinating. Before we get to that, we probably should say at the end of the initial run, we learned that Axel actually was in league with the coach. They had planned this rescue of Boys R Us, and it was intended to actually kill off the members that they didn't want. And the only two that were supposed to be standing were Axel and You Go Girl. So we do learn that he's perhaps even more despicable than he appeared at the beginning because he had planned this and he had planned for this slaughter, this massacre. He just didn't intend to die.
And it's Wolverine that gives us that truth, which is fascinating. The other key piece I didn't mention, it's right as Axel is dying, his like torso's been severed, is when he remembers that girl's name that he heard. Oh yeah, her name was Felicity. And Felicity is the name of a series from this era too, which is Axel Clooney and Felicity cracked me up.
So the spirit of 2022, are we ready for this?
We are ready. It is a different time and Axel comes back in giant size ecstatics, number one. But let's talk about the change in our lives in the last 20 years.
Absolutely. So some of the things that came to mind is the nature of stardom. So fame and money and sex, still important, but how one achieves that, we've gone from television and movies as the primary medium for doing that to social media. And now there are endless platforms. I won't even dare to list them off for self-promotion. And popularity is now in many ways measured by your likes, your followers. So this is the age of social media stardom and followers, which we see in the books. It's the age of disinformation. And this is a part of how Axel runs the Excellent now and how he tries to achieve fame and to discredit Ecstatic is not by trying, well, he does try to one-up them, but also by spreading disinformation. And there's an interesting sort of line or two that he gives to, it's not dupe, but it's sort of the anti-dupe, that it doesn't matter.
The anti-dupe, by the way, is pood.
Pood, yes, thank you. I had to do it backwards. That facts, you know, they're trying to dig up skeletons in the closet, doxing, if you will. And at one point they realize, you know what, let's not even bother with this. Let's just make stuff up. Because at the end of the day, falsehoods, if they're aggressively pursued, are actually more effective than facts, than what you can actually dig up. So this is the age of disinformation, scientific skepticism, alternative facts. We now have
let me introduce for just a second how we got here. Because in 2001, I got my first cell phone. And it was 200 minutes a month, and it cost me $40 a month. There was no texting. There was no data. Now we're carrying around these streaming devices that are our GPSs and our cameras and our social media connection. We don't answer the phone anymore because it's easier or more convenient to text. We have text etiquette. We have social media obsession and its impact on mental health. It's instant gratification all the time. You push a button and someone drives a box to your house or brings lunch to your house and drops it off. We download, you know, back in 2001, you had to download things illegally if you want, but now it's streaming. There's no DVDs. There's no VCRs. There's no cassette tapes. Everything is wireless and convenient and all the time. We went through a large era where in 2001 is kind of when Facebook and MySpace and all those were getting started, and people started feeling comfortable sharing their lives. There were apps that said, check into this location and let people know where you are. Mark yourself safe during the tornado. Show pictures of your children. It was constant sharing, constant all the time. And then we started having people weaponizing camps and finding ways to increase advertising dollars by marketing outrage and forming groups, which started giving more voice to politically intense and far right organizations. But during a time as well when cancel culture became a thing, we have the Me Too movement and the Black Lives Matter movement, and gay marriage is passed and trans rights are being talked about. In comparison to this kind of era where we're seeing more diversity celebrated, we're seeing the white man say, hey, it's not our time, build the wall, you know, lock her up, let's do all of these things. So these camps of people started forming, and it went real extreme after the election of Trump. And I'm oversimplifying here, but social media no longer feels safe. It's no longer a thing that we can trust. We recognize the corruption. We see these movements that are anti-abortion and anti-gay and anti-trans and anti-drag queen and anti-immigrant being the ones that are doing the White Lives Matters movements. And they're literally Nazi protests outside of drag queen story hours. We've gone into an era where guns are a thing that we shrug off. I saw a post the other day that said, I have to show my ID if I want to buy 2 bottles of NyQuil, but I can get an AR-15 without asking questions. We're in this very weird era. You're talking about questioning science, COVID-19, and anti-vaxxers and anti-maskers. And I'm summing up a lot of shit, but a lot happened before Zeitgeist came back. That's what I'm getting at. And he's no longer pretending to be a hero. He's doing the same thing, but in a very Trump-like way where he doesn't care what people think. I'm gonna be the worst version of myself. Everyone's gonna know it and they're gonna love me anyway. Look at the fame and followers I can get and the literal increase in power by being the absolute worst because everybody's celebrating it.
Absolutely. I like that you brought up the fact that we now recognize that social media is unhelpful and unhealthy. I saw this transformation in the classroom because we've always talked about it in my classes because it becomes a new way that one can communicate and one can present themselves and receive feedback from others. This is a social environment. And when I started talking about it in the classroom, let's say 2011, 2012, it was just blind adoration. Students loved it. And how dare you stand up there in the front of the classroom and tell me that this might be unhealthy? You know, sit down and shut up, old man. But roughly 10 years later, we have all collectively as a society come to recognize, along with data and studies, that as you say, it is really unhealthy. And I've seen my own child just flat out turn it off because it makes people feel crappy about themselves and also spreads disinformation and creates these ideological ecosystems like you mentioned. But I think that's a big part of this is that we now recognize that social media is not all it was cracked up to be.
We wanted to trust in the goodness of people. We wanted to trust it. For me as a queer person, I never expected to have a place at the table, but then suddenly Obama was elected and it felt like I had a place at the table. And when Trump came into power, I was so genuinely flummoxed and surprised that people could be this indecent. Look at the history of the world. My word, it's not that surprising. But I think we're just beginning to understand the impact of all of this. And Peter Milligan, as he writes Zeitgeist in the more modern comics, really leans hard into this. And it's pretty brilliant, actually, when you watch how this character started and what fame meant then, but what it means now, because his motivations are now entirely corrupt, not just self-serving, but entirely corrupt. He's gone full evil. He's become the worst version of himself, which we can argue is kind of what happened to Trump. The more power he got, the worse he got. And there's a lot of people in that camp along with him.
You mentioned a lot of really good points. As far as Trumpism, you know, you mentioned the hatred and anger that we thought we had overcome perhaps with Obama. And now with the emergence of Trump, here it was emerging as if we didn't even know it was there. So on the one hand, it becomes the energy of the movement. But on the other hand, as you say, you know, this is the history of the world. Of course, we shouldn't be too surprised.
There's warnings about fascism and the end of democracy, and people are still, you know, in his camp. And Zeitgeist is kind of that guy in a lot of ways.
This is one of the things I wanted to bring up is, and this is, I suppose it's related a little bit to social media stardom, is that transgressions aren't what they used to be. Transgressions in some ways are a form of cachet. And even if they're negative, you can spin them with this information. So you can always blame it on it being a witch hunt or the other side's media or the deep state. It's not really true. It's false. Don't believe it.
But the interesting component to that, though, is transgressions are not as big a deal for some because we're also still in cancel culture. We find that one, the picture of you in blackface in college 30 years ago, and you're out. Your election's over. Your power is ended. One person complains about that sexual inappropriateness and you're done. But on a certain level, we excuse it, right? I remember being so fascinated by the Supreme Court appointing of Brett Kavanaugh and that crazy hearing that took place and how we kind of just shrugged it by. But other people we hold entirely accountable. You have to be in the certain camp in order to be held to a particular standard. It's interesting. It's completely unreasonable. But Zeitgeist occupies that space where other people would get canceled for much less. So are we okay to jump into Giant Size Ecstatics?
Absolutely. Let's go.
This is a weird book. You have to be familiar with the original in order to view this. There's an entire new group of characters from Uno, who is another giant eyeball. There's a weird number of giant eyeballs in Marvel Comics or people covered in eyeballs. There is Mirror Girl, who reflects your true self to you, which whatever that means. There's Hurt John, who sees your pain. There's the A, and there's Fatty, who we talked about earlier. A lot of legacy characters. Instead of creating new characters with unlikable powers, it's this person's daughter and that person's successor, which is interesting. I'm always fascinated when they do that. So in Giant Size Ecstatics number one, we see a media report that kind of recounts the history of the original team. It says they were the most recognizable faces on Earth and they loved it. Besides fighting a bunch of bad guys, this team was famous for many things, like changing their name from X-Force to Ecstatics, their tireless struggle against obscurity, their merciless product placement, the huge appearance fees that they were said to demand, the booze, the bust-ups, the braggadocio, personalities like Axel Clooney, a.k.a. Zeitgeist, Edie Sawyer, a.k.a. You Go Girl, and bad boy Tyke Alucard, a.k.a. the Anarchist, sure kept the nation coming back for those pay-per-view missions. Of course, much of the team's fame was possible by the fly-on-the-wall camera of the unlikely sex symbol known as Dupe, though maybe the thing Ecstatics was most famous for beyond the money, sex scandals, and celebrity was their insanely high body count. And we're launching a new team called the Excellent.
The new names, I think that's so funny. It's almost like a rebranding. Okay, so what's flashier than X-Force? Ecstatics. What's flashier than Ecstatics? How about the Excellent? You know, where does it end?
So Zeitgeist is back in power. He forms a group called the Excellent, and he's looking for a teleporter. We're not going to learn his motivations here for a minute. And it's pulled across this issue and then 2 5-issue limited series afterward. They're all kind of combined in one long 12-issue run, if you will. He tries to recruit the daughter of Yugo Girl, who's a girl named Katie Jones. And she's like, you're Zeitgeist, but you used to be handsome in an old guy kind of way. And he agrees now he's monstrous. I'm the spirit of the times. So he calls himself monstrous, says he's the spirit of the times. Look at me, Katie. Don't you see the world we're living in? I'm gathering a team of evil Dada shock troops for the culture war that lies ahead. I call them the Excellent. He's kidnapped some scientists. He's made them build a device that's trying to reform brutally Venus de Milo from like scattered atoms. And he needs a teleporter on his team, but Katie refuses. She ends up joining in Ecstatics instead, which is the team being led by Mr. Sensitive. We haven't talked about Mr. Sensitive at all. Do you want to talk about this guy?
We can. I mean, if there was one character at the end of the initial run who I had a little bit of sympathy for, it was Mr. Sensitive, because I don't know, there was some kindness to him, at least some self-awareness, some caring for others. But now in this new iteration, I've sort of lost that. I mean, he's still concerned about followers and he's still concerned about making sure that they're popular. He's a little bit of, he's hollowed out a little bit, I think.
Mr. Sensitive is a mutant. His name is Guy Smith. He has kind of purple, pimply skin and horns. His power is he has superhuman senses. So like Wolverine or Daredevil, there's like a danger sense present there. He can levitate himself as well. He is an odd counterpoint to Zeitgeist. He's a likable character. There's a lot of room given to explore who he is. I like him. I'm fond of him, I think. I think if I did an episode like this, I'd find that I had more thoughts about him. But yeah, he's an interesting counterpoint to Zeitgeist.
He is. And do you like how they did his dialogue? He always seems to stutter a little bit at times. I don't think it's a stutter. I think perhaps it's he's more feeling and more caring and more unsure of himself, perhaps.
Yeah, he's slightly off-putting to look at, but his name is Mr. Sensitive. The idea is that he's going to listen and feel and see, where Zeitgeist is the good-looking guy who's going to destroy you with acid. They even kind of have, there's an indirect comparison that's often drawn between the two of them and what it means in this leadership. Okay, so when we jump into the excellent series, Zeitgeist is very much in the fake news era. There is very little effort put into disguising the fact that this is a Trumpism story. But it's the era of fake news. He has 110 million followers online due to his fake messaging about his enemies. He's branded these campaigns, just like Coach taught him, on how to do these awful things. But it's different now in 2022 than it was in 2001, because with social media, I can put up a post and get all these follows. I didn't have to put it on Entertainment Tonight or take out the billboard. All I need is the followers. Zeitgeist burns some scientists. He keeps trying to recruit a bunch of teleporters. A Mirror Girl ends up showing him his true self in a moment, and he just looks like this horrid monster. He attacks the hologram rock concert of Rick Ragger, who's clearly Mick Jagger. He fights Ecstatics. Katie has joined them now, using the name Gone Gal. Vivisector gets vivisected. Again, it's another horrible murder of a queer character. He doesn't get murdered, actually. He survives in a chair, at least for a while. Zeitgeist badly burns Katie's face with like an acid burn, and they teleport away. Axel has to hail a taxi home. His teammate Joe Bomb is literally dying. He lashes out at his teammates. Poods flying around. Eventually, we learn that after his original death, Zeitgeist had been kept alive by something called, quote, dupe ice, which restructured his body, resurrected him over and over again, and has kind of driven him crazy. It's rewritten his brain cells. He watched his own funeral on TV, and it notes that it was attended by A-list celebrities with a eulogy by Captain America, which is hilarious. Joe Bomb ends up dying. Zeitgeist is romancing Mirror Girl. Well, romancing. He's fucking her and, like, coercing her constantly. There's a bunch of... Well, there's a new guy recruited named Billy McMullen who has some problematic teleportation powers because it breaks people into pieces. But this guy's obsessed with finding a teleporter. That's like his whole motivation. That and followers.
The romance with Mirror Girl frustrated me so much. I'm like, girl, please leave this guy. We find out that one of the new powers that he gathered, I suppose, through his resurrection is this mesmeric power. So he's kind of hypnotizing her. Still, I felt like, gosh, this is no excuse. This is awful. You're a pretty young woman. You seem to be kind and caring. This is the most despicable person you could ever date in your entire life. He treats you like dirt. And I just hated seeing her go back, betray her friends over and over and over again. It just infuriated me.
It's very uncomfortable. But we find ourselves blaming her and not him. You know, like she's a character with her own will, but she can't seem to break away. It's uncomfortable. And again, what does power take? There's the commentary there. Like, what does it take for this character to succeed? We get a bunch more weird characters in the X-Force Ecstatics tradition, like Stripe and Fluff. Do you want to talk about these guys?
Oh my goodness, they outdid themselves. Okay, so Stripe manipulates stripe patterns. Okay.
That's it. Stripe's power is to manipulate stripes.
Manipulate stripes. Evidently, she hung out a lot in department stores and would play around with clothing that had stripes. The one thing that kind of made sense is that if you think about prison bars, those are stripes. So there's where you bring in Stripe. If you're trying to break out of prison, she can manipulate the bars. So that's interesting.
A real stupid power, but they kind of use it in cool ways. And tell us about Fluff. Fluff makes me very uncomfortable.
Okay. So Fluff somehow manipulates the lint in one's belly button. Is that right?
I mean, any lint. Any like stray linty stuff floating around in the air, he can weaponize and combine.
So he had this hilarious costume that reminded me of the lead singer of Aerosmith, but it had this huge V-neck that went all the way down to his navel because
Steven Tyler, of course.
And so he had a big hairy chest and he had, you know, the big flowing hair that almost came out of, you know, hair bands from the 1980s. And the V goes all the way down to his belly button. He's very self-confident in himself, but he somehow has been able to light lint on fire and he can project it at people. And this is also another very strange, ridiculous power, right in the tradition of these comics.
These comics continue to do what the original series did, poke fun at everything, make fun of it in problematic ways, but in a way that kind of feels safe because everything's on the table. Mr. Sensitive recruits a character named Girl Joe, who is a non-binary social media influencer. And the name Girl Joe already is problematic because it is a non-binary character using two gendered names in their title. It's uncomfortable. Anyway, she ends up getting some followers away from Zeitgeist, so he's super crazy. He's also very jealous because Fluff doesn't want to listen to his shit and is also trying to sleep with Mirror Girl. And he refuses to use Girl Joe's correct pronouns, publishes their, like, Girl Joe's address so that people will go after this reporter who has made statements against Zeitgeist, which is almost the worst thing he's done so far, which is saying something. Fluff ends up becoming a celebrity. Zeitgeist is furious. He's starting to lose control. His left eye gets burnt out by the A. Oh, we haven't talked about that. Do you want to talk about the A very briefly?
The A is the son of the anarchist, correct? And is even more brash and perhaps less self-aware than his dad.
There's two more mutants. I'll let you talk about them quickly as well if you want. There's Tootlepip and Whoosh.
I'll talk about Tootlepip, another great name, but a teleporter that comes into the mix and befriends Mirror Girl. You think that they're perhaps going to figure out a way for Mirror Girl to detach herself from Zeitgeist and perhaps even to betray him. It doesn't come to be. So Tootlepip was a character I was rooting for because she seemed to understood the situation that Mirror Girl was in, that it was a bad situation, and that maybe they could take out Zeitgeist. But unfortunately, they didn't quite get there, and she meets an untimely end. So that's Tootlepip.
There's a lot of high body count and a lot of crazy characters that are bizarre that keep coming into this all, and it's fun. And none of them are ever going to be on Krakoa ever. That's the whole thing. So the end of the first series, if I'm oversimplifying, we see Zeitgeist slowly, like, revealing himself. There is no more mask. He is clearly obsessed. He's a monster. He's saying out loud, "I'm a monster." He sees himself as a monster. He deserves to fuck whoever he wants and to have whatever he wants. So they steal a spell from Doctor Strange's Sanctum Sanctorum. And once he gets 500 million followers, there will be enough fodder for the spell to be able to give him ultimate power. That's kind of how the first volume ends. And then there is another volume of The Excellent that follows, in which we see Zeitgeist kind of losing more and more control. He's becoming more and more unhinged. He's threatening people. He's like warning that they're going to have dire ends unless they do what they say. He's still trying to get Venus de Milo reassembled. At this point, you kind of don't know what his thoughts are. Like, whatever his initial goal was, he's just kind of slowly going mad. He tries taking over the mind of Dead Girl. Oh, Dead Girl, outside of Dupe, is another character that's had a little bit of resonance in the Marvel Universe. Do you want to talk about Dead Girl? I actually kind of like her.
Dead Girl is pretty cool. I mean, she seems to be a little bit more impervious to Zeitgeist than others. She'll often say, "Look, you can't mesmerize me. I'm dead," even though he seems to be able to do it a little bit anyway, but she pops in and out. She seems to be an ally of the Ecstatics. She's kind of cool.
She's got like a relationship on a mutant power level with the afterlife. She's an interesting character. I think she has a lot of potential, actually. Anyway, she ends up, Dead Girl channels the spirit of Yugo Girl to like distract him while she's getting away because she can manipulate ghosts. And he's like, "Why are girls always ganging up on me?" And Ecstatics, the Mr. Sensitive team's like starting to steal his fame. So the Excellent rob a bank. They bring a new character named Dox in. And Dox is a character I know you have to be fascinated with. Tell me about Dox.
Oh my gosh. So, gosh.
What is it? What does Dox mean?
So Dox means sort of weaponizing and attacking people via just sort of negative information, perhaps false information, digging up dirt, skeletons in the closet. You know, although they didn't say it, it almost reminded me a little bit of revenge porn, just relentlessly and ruthlessly going after people online. Is that your understanding of it?
Yeah. It's weaponizing personal information against someone, basically. So they literally recruit a character named Dox, which is an amazing thing for this. They expose ecstatics for a whole bunch of lies. There's attacks on Times Square, Hollywood Boulevard. They keep weaponizing information. They're turning everyone away from the decent people. Like, look at these horrible things. And also ignore all the horrible things about me. Like, follow, and subscribe. Here we go. Which is very much that this story is. At Zeithaus, as the spell starts... That's their base name, by the way. Zeithaus. The spell starts to take place. And Zeitgeist is changing into a more of a golden form. Literally developing god powers, and he is spreading ever worse rumors. Girl Joe's still involved. His paranoia is heightened into this point where he ends up killing Docs just so he can make up facts about other people without any sort of credit or truth behind it at all. Is that how you kind of understood that motivation?
Yeah, absolutely. And he admits as such that it's why even waste time trying to dig up skeletons in the closet when I can just make up stuff? It's quicker. And if you relentlessly push it, it's even more effective.
And he gets godhood. All the things that everyone's been warning all along, like it keeps getting worse, it keeps getting worse. And now this evil, reprehensible man is a god. And tell us what happens once Zeitgeist becomes a god or has godlike powers.
Well, he manifests them in different ways. He has the rest of the team sort of kneel before him as he levitates for a little while. To them, it seems like about 30 minutes. And they're all getting sore, just like, you know, kneeling and not moving. But while he's doing that, he's moving through all these different dimensions, almost becoming bored by them. You know, he's going to all these different dimensions, seeing all these different things. And he's sort of like, all right, well, been there, done that. Let's move on. Yeah. So
absolute power corrupts, right? He starts with these powers, kind of his mind is shifting into other dimensions. He's going mad. And if I'm oversimplifying, the way this story ends is Venus de Milo finally shows back up, who is, I don't know, the Marley to his Scrooge, and teleports him to a dimension where it's kind of like a hell of his own making. He's caught up in this place where he's trapped, surrounded by the essences of everyone he's killed. It's kind of an unsatisfying ending, if I'm honest. I didn't love the end as much as I enjoyed the buildup. It went on a little too long. It's crazy, 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 and then it's just over. And I wanted him to have much more comeuppance than this.
Oh, absolutely. It happens really quick and deeply ironic, I suppose. He spent so much time trying to resurrect this particular character, Venus de Milo. And then when she's finally able to do her thing, she gets rid of him in a snap. It was very abrupt. And that was kind of it.
Nothing matters to him anymore. And again, do you want to talk about the Trumpism allegory here, the rise of power, the corruption of power, and what ultimately becomes? I mean, everybody dies at the end, right?
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you too about this ultimate pursuit of being a social media god. Was that the goal? And what does that tell us about society? Is that what we're all after?
Yeah, I mean, we can take this. What was his motivation? I think if you are so obsessed with self-importance at the cost of everything else, it's money and it's power. And, you know, shifting it to the Trumpism allegory, the world is dying around us. Have you read Game of Thrones or seen Game of Thrones? There's the constant threat of the White Walkers, but we're just so caught up in each other's shit that we forget that that's happening. This is that. Like, if we're only caught up in the idea of fame itself and ignoring all corruption and demonizing everyone else, I think we sometimes forget there is another world after that. There are people outside of that. But we're so obsessed with this idea of celebrity and fame. The human brain is so wired for it that this kind of likes and subscribes stuff has plummeted us to a level of dysfunction. News these days is coming, and this is the other era of the Zeitgeist, I think. It's coming so fast. In 2001, the really bad news was a few months apart. It was Columbine. It was Matthew Shepard. It was 9/11. But we would have these big stories, and then it would take us a while to reckon with it. In today's day and age, we're so desensitized because the headlines just hit us constantly. And Zeitgeist in this story has figured out how to latch on to that. And I think, you know, Peter Milligan wrote something really smart here in that way, showing the transformation of this very corrupt character. And, you know, if we read this story 5 years, 10 years, 20 years from now, what do we learn about the 2023 era? Just like we're reflecting on the 2001 era when this book first launched. I don't know if you have thoughts there or not.
Absolutely. So there is something about, I think, the pace of this second run in 2022, which reflects what you were talking about. Information moves so fast. Social media stardom rises rises and falls so quickly. There is a pace to these missions that Zeitgeist is taking them on. It's frantic. It's hectic. And all the while, he's obsessively following, you know, how many people are following, how many have I gained, how many have I lost? It is just this relentless obsession with the followers. And, you know, all the carnage that's happening is just peripheral. You know, it's just, what kind of crazy mission can we go on? Who cares how many people die or what destruction happens? Followers up, followers down.
And like a true narcissist, I think extreme narcissists, when I'm happy, you better be happy. When I'm mad, you better be scared or catering to me. When I want something, you better give it to me. Like if you cross me, there's going to be consequences. And that era about him, there is no effort to make this character anything redeemable at all. From his first appearance on, but particularly in these last 11 issues, which was funny because when you and I first started talking about doing this character, I realized, oh, there's modern stories about him. He came back. So we had to wait for a little while until he... I'm feeling a certain way after this conversation, Michael. I mean, we're talking about the Zeitgeist, not the character so much as the modern trend. And I'm having a difficult time articulating what the fuck is happening in the world right now as I'm raising children. I don't know. Do you have kids?
I do.
Okay. Yeah, it's a weird time to be a parent, right? Like, it's odd. I don't know how to prepare them. The world is too different. I don't know what to say to them ever. And I think the energy I'm feeling is a lot related to that. This character makes me feel a little bit helpless. He's exhausting.
Well, one of the reasons may be because Trump is still in the zeitgeist, and he may very well be back.
It's maddening to see horrible people receive so many excuses. I mean, God, Harvey Weinstein and Epstein, right? Like there's these giant names that had so much power that have fallen, but there's other names that we're just providing constant excuses for. Zeitgeist is exhausting. He makes me tired.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you're waiting for his comeuppance. And it doesn't come until the very end. And perhaps that's a little bit of wish fulfillment on behalf of the author and the artist here. But in real life, we're still waiting for the comeuppance.
When we're launching into the new 70s era on the show, the conversation changes. The characters are starting to question the government, and we're building toward the Nixon is the leader of the Nazi infiltrators of the United States government storyline, which literally takes place in stories we're going to talk about this year. But even now, that story feels tame compared to the zeitgeist level that we're talking about. What was done in secret then is being done in public now, and people are celebrating it. This guy got 500 million followers, not through mind control, but because people liked what he was doing. Fuck, that's why I'm uncomfortable.
I was just going to say, you've answered your own question. This is why you're uncomfortable, Chad.
When I have big feelings, the way I sort through them is by writing essays just for myself. When my dad died, I sat down and wrote an essay for 3 hours because it helps me sort out what I'm doing. So listeners, thank you for listening to me process through this. But that's why I'm so uncomfortable, because 500 million people followed this man and he's the fucking worst. And that's too much of an allegory to our modern life. Fuck. Gross.
To be continued. Maybe we'll be doing this again in a few years.
I want to pick like a little light, fluffy character next time. Zeitgeist is rough, man.
All right. That's fair enough.
What are your feelings as you're sitting with this at the conclusion of this conversation?
Oh, gosh. You mentioned having children. So, and how we have them navigate these moments, these times. So on the one hand, I mentioned that my son, who's 19, has sort of left social media or has very minimal contact with it because he's realized it's toxic. It makes him feel very bad about himself. So that's a reflection, I think, on how the younger generation has become self-aware. But he's old enough to also talk about politics and to talk about where we're headed. He's actually more optimistic than me about what could potentially happen this year in November. So I like that. I like to see that kind of optimism. I like to be with optimistic people, but there is a lot of uneasiness. And on the heels of the pandemic too, just this level of unease and sort of just being unsettled. I think that's the word I would use. It's just part of being unsettled in these times.
You and I are of a certain age, and the reason we latched onto comic books to shift the conversation back to your work, I think we found escapism. Everybody has their motivation for why the X-Men feel special to them, but modern readers are going to connect to these books for different reasons. They're going to look at these classic stories and look into the history for different reasons, maybe similar reasons, but when you grow up in different eras, that definition of escapism and being othered and finding ourselves in these books, I think that conversation changes with us because even the way the books are being made is different now based on the zeitgeist. Is your study, and this is not meant to be a probing question, but is your study going to have the same validity in 5 years when the conversations based on the interviews you'd be having with people would be completely different? Because even the study you're doing is based on now. It's an interesting
Absolutely.
thought to see that shifting.
Oh, it absolutely is. But that's one thing about sociology, that as society changes, so does our work, so do our findings, and in a way that gives us job security because we've never completely figured out how human behavior works in groups and in society. We're constantly exploring it. But as you were talking, I was thinking this is one way I can sort of think about comparing different respondents is by looking at age. And I do ask in the interviews how one gets started, a little bit of a life history about how they get into what they're into. And so I can absolutely compare older respondents to younger ones to see if there's anything different about what they're getting out of these books. So food for thought for me. Thanks, Chad.
Yeah, I mean, this book in particular, the X-Force era, was created for a particular reason during a particular time. And then the revisiting of it, fascinating. This is a crazy corner of the X-Men universe, and it's relatively robust and well explored. This was a fun conversation, even though I'm super uncomfortable, not because of you, but because of this topic. I gotta go sit with this for a little while. What a joy to connect with you, my friend. I really do enjoy. You'd be someone I would love to get coffee with once a week and just pick your brain about what you're doing. Let
Likewise.
our listeners know where they can find you, and where they can look at the results of your study or the progress, or even take the initial, I don't know, the
The
questionnaire.
survey.
Yeah,
Yeah.
survey.
The survey is up on my personal website. Probably the easiest way to get to it is go to Towson's website. So www.towson, TOWSON.edu, and just type my name into the search box. And there you'll see my faculty page and you'll see a link to my personal website. And that's where you can read the latest publications. You'll see a link to the survey. I encourage everyone who is engaged in any way, you can be a big fan or a small fan of these things, to take the survey and to follow along.
Do you have a prediction about when this will all be complete?
I do not. Sometime before I die. How about that?
I think that's entirely fair. Michael, what a joy. Thank you for your time and talents. I know episodes like this take some reading. I hope it was an enjoyable research venture for you as well.
I love comics and I love being on this show, Chad. You're wonderful with what you do.
Thank you so much. That's the kindest thing. One of the big reasons I put the show out at the pace that I do is because there's so much professional interest in it. And that's always the biggest form of flattery for me, is seeing people who not only are willing to spend their time and do the work, but come back again and again. It's just incredibly humbling. But I'm really grateful for that feedback. Thank you.
Let's do it again.
I would love to. Let's have you back on. We'll talk. We're in the 70s on my show. I've got the whole show mapped out for the whole year, and we have a lot we can talk about. Absolutely. The next episode coming out on the show right around this time is going to be Amazing Adventures number 16. It is the conclusion of the Beast Turns Blue story where he fights the Juggernaut. There's a lot of really interesting, super obscure, like comic book knowledge in this particular episode, which will feature Ryan Cady, Chris Magnus, and my dear friend Philip Seavey. Out on the Patreon immediately after this is a very different conversation. Sarah Gailey and I are going to be talking about all about Kandra, the immortal external benefactress of the Thieves and Assassins Guild, who is a messy giant woman. We're going to have a lot of fun talking about her as well. Thank you, everybody, for listening and for the ongoing support. Thank you, Michael, so much for this time. We'll see you all back here next time on Gray Malkin Lane's Patreon.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text health to 85109. That's health to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.